Hello, and welcome to another episode of True Stories of Good People, a GoFundMe Heroes production. I'm your host, Kelsey Little. In each episode of this podcast, we sit down with someone who's making a difference in other people's lives, or who's had their life changed by someone kind. Katie Ishizuka and Ramon Stevens are the powerful duo behind The Conscious Kid, an education, research, and policy organization dedicated to equity and promoting healthy racial identity development in children. In addition to their incredible advocacy work and their amazingly popular Instagram account, they have recently harnessed their community to help provide rent relief for families struggling during the COVID-19 crisis. Hello, True Stories of Good People listeners. I'm beyond thrilled to be here today chatting with the duo behind The Conscious Kid, Katie Ishizuka and Ramon Stevens. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us. It's such an honor, Kelsey.
Oh, the honor is all mine, truly. So I would love to start out by getting to know you two a bit more. I think you're based in San Diego, aren't you?
Yeah, we are based here in San Diego in Southern California here on the West Coast. So loving the sunshine.
That's awesome. I live in San Diego, too. We're neighbors. I know.
Wow.
How long have y'all lived here?
So we've been living here for about 5 years now, going on 5 years. Definitely loving it so far. You know, the people are super friendly and definitely all good things.
Yeah, Ramon is a fifth year PhD student at UC San Diego.
Oh my gosh, I went there.
Oh, wow, they had a synergy. All right.
That's so cool. I do not have a PhD though, so good on you.
Oh, it's overrated, don't worry.
What would you say is both of your favorite things about our fair city?
One of our favorite things is we both teach at UC San Diego as well. So we teach a class to undergraduate seniors on critical race media literacy. So one of my favorite things is just the students here and being at the university and teaching.
Yeah, I agree. The students here are awesome. The culture in San Diego is also really, really great and seems to be a little bit more open-minded, even though we know that there are obviously, you know, still limitations, but definitely seems to be pretty embracive of the Conscious Kid and the work that we do here. So, yeah.
I love that. Oh my gosh, that makes me happy. As I mentioned up top, and as you're just talking about, you're the co-founders of an incredible nonprofit organization called The Conscious Kid. I would love to learn about the origins of this. It has grown so big at this point. So maybe let's start with what exactly is The Conscious Kid and where did the idea come from in the first place?
Great. So The Conscious Kid, we are an education, research, policy organization, and we're dedicated to creating positive and healthy racial identity development for youth, families, parents, educators alike. The need for the organization kind of came out of our own personal needs that we were experiencing in life. So we're both parents, obviously black and brown children. Our children are particularly look physically black. So we wanted to make sure that they were affirmed in their experiences and in life. And so we were just looking for books that could affirm their experiences. And we went to the local public library, and we asked them, you know, do you have any books featuring black children? And, you know, scratched their head, took them a couple hours, came back later, and out of tens of thousands of books, they only had 3 stories, and they weren't very empowering. Like, one was some girl praying to God, their hair wasn't nappy, and
oh my God.
And it was just not the kind of messages that we wanted our, you know, children to be able to. We didn't want our children to see themselves in that way. We were looking for something more affirming. So as we, you know, we're like, maybe is this library? Is this a thing? So we started to kind of research it and found out that this is a thing, you know, I would say nationwide, at least, where finding a representation of black children is at a minimum, right? There's more animal characters than there are black children of color. And even within the children of color sect, it's like very much minimal black characters. And of that, black authors who write those stories are still at a minimum. And so that's important, right, as far as getting accurate narratives and understandings of those communities and to push back against stereotypes. So as we started finding that out and doing more research, you know, we're talking to our parents who are friends of ours also that have kids of color, and they're having the same troubles as far as finding these empowering messages. And, you know, we're like, let's just make this a project. Clearly there's a gap. The research shows that there's a gap in it, and there's a lot of people that were kind of asking for these things, and we had started to collect all these different books that we had done on our own research and lending them out to people. So that kind of started the lending library and the origins of it. But we also knew that it was much more than just children's books, right? These issues stem from structural policies and laws, for example, cultural norms and practices. So we knew that we wanted to approach it from many different angles, but that was kind of the entree, was through our own children, our own experiences as Black and Brown folks.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that background. And I think that it's, like you said, it's grown into so much more than the book aspect. I believe that you also develop courses and educational materials on anti-racism work for, you know, classrooms and for the internet. How did that get started?
Yeah, so children's books are just one tool for this work, but really, you know, as Ramon mentioned, this is a systemic issue. It's you know, involved in the policies and education curriculum. And so our work is really, it uses children's book as one effective and practical tool that, you know, is really easy for caregivers and educators to use. But ultimately, we need to be engaging in larger forms of education and disruption and making sure that caregivers and educators are also educated and empowered to have conversations about race and racism from an early age and often, and normalize that. And also not just talking about racism, but taking action to disrupt racism. So providing the tools, resources, and information and making it as accessible as possible is really a large part of what we do and our mission.
And just to add on real quick, and we also, you know, prior to us having kids, we do have a history of designing curriculum and doing critical multicultural education. So as far as designing those kind of pieces of curriculum for teachers and educators, that part naturally was a synergy, you know, when the mission kind of came about when we started having our own children.
That is, it's so powerful and needed what you are doing. I just think it's incredible. So racism, systemic racism, is such a large and pervasive issue. Why is education in this space so important, especially for younger generations?
So education is kind of two part, right, of why it's important. One is the general kind of awareness and reflection, but then the second part is the actual action, right? And so when you look at the research about when, you know, when racial bias starts at a young age. And when I guess when I say racism, racial bias is one part of that. Racism is actually the structural, legalistic part of it. But we know that racial bias, if you look at research, for example, by Barron and Banaji, 2006, it shows that racial bias starts as early as age 3, and then at the age of age 7, it becomes fixed. And when we say racial bias, we're talking about a pro-white, anti-Black kind of attitudes, racial attitudes. And so after the age of 7, although people might explicitly not say the N-word or say stereotypes, internally, they may still be thinking those things. So disrupting it at as early as possible is crucial, because we know, since racism is embedded in all of our institutions, that's in the media that they watch, the conversations, the segregated neighborhoods, you know, things that may or may not be so explicit, because those things start and surrounding children from birth, having conversations and creating awareness around it so that you can disrupt it and then taking actual action is important for, you know, pushing back against the racist socialization, not only of your child, but for yourself and for socially, you know, society at large.
I'm curious, because you do so many different kinds of work on this project, how do you reach people? You've got a huge Instagram presence, which is where I first saw you. I see people sharing your stuff like every day in my Instagram stories feed. You've got your website and you work with classrooms. So how did you kind of foster this network that you have?
It's really just been grassroots. There's no real, I guess, yeah, that's the best way to describe it, is just, we just started putting the information out there that's helpful to us and that we, you know, want to make sure is accessible and free and able to be, you know, readily understood by anyone, so, and of all ages. And so just putting the information out there, and it's just slowly grown from there. And, you know, we're super grateful that people find it meaningful enough to share, and that's just helped us grow naturally.
That's so awesome. And on the Instagram piece, as long as I've been following you, it's been really huge, but did that grow big? Was it big from the beginning, or did it kind of have booms? Like, how did it get so big?
Yeah, it's been sort of gradual across the years. You know, we've been around for about 4 years now, but I would say there's definitely been a jump in the last month or so of a lot of new people being really interested in this work and in doing this work with their young children or, you know, the students that they work with. And so, you know, we're super grateful to have a growing community and more people tuned into the work that we're doing.
That's so awesome. So shifting gears a little bit, our nation is currently facing two really big crises at the same time. We've got the COVID-19 pandemic, which hit most U.S. cities really hard in March. And then, like we were just talking about, the pervasive and systemic racism that has plagued our country since its founding. Research has shown that Black and Brown communities are disproportionately affected by COVID-19. What role does racism and racial bias play in this pandemic that we're living through?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's all these different things that COVID-19 highlights that were already there. So when we're talking about police violence in particular, we already know that Black and Brown communities are already being targeted more by the police, particularly Black folks. We already know that there's more police presence within Black communities. So with the COVID-19 thing highlighting all of that, the folks that are getting kind of targeted for whether it's basic violations or even if it's the policing of COVID-19 itself, all of that kind of gets heightened. And then additionally, we're talking about racism, there's a class intersection, right? So the work we do critical race work, and critical race work, and it's is a little bit more unique than, say, anti-race work because it's intersectional, right? It looks at the roles of class, it looks at the roles of gender, it looks at sexual orientation, and how all these things intersect with race to create a unique experience. So when we're talking about Black folks, there's a class intersection. So with COVID-19 already decreasing jobs for, you know, the U.S. at large, that will impact Black people more so, particularly because there is already the low income piece due to segregation of schools, segregation of resources, whether it's biased attitudes in the professional environment, lack of Black critical mass in higher leadership areas. All of these things, you know, highlight the income piece as well. And so one of the things that in intersectional, as far as looking at that, is we talk about for Black trans folks in particularly have been targeted and marginalized by COVID-19. So all of these different layers intersect to create these unique kind of modes of oppression within the Black community itself. But that's just a little bit of how race intersects with all of these notions as far as how Black people in particular have been marginalized and how COVID-19 has helped to kind of make that more salient.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's so much need in those communities right now. And that brings us to your amazing GoFundMe campaign. So you two have started something really powerful and incredible to help these communities that really need it during this time. You launched it on March 31st, and we'll get to how big it's grown since then because it's kind of mind-blowing. So I'd love if you could tell us about your COVID-19 rent relief project and where the idea came from.
Yeah, so it was back in March and all the states had been shutting down and millions of people started losing their jobs or hours at their jobs. And it was a really scary time. And while some people were out stocking up at grocery stores to isolate in their homes, you know, for the foreseeable future for weeks at a time, there was also this massive food insecurity and housing insecurity happening, which again exists all the time, but has now been made even worse by the pandemic. And two of the very first people we saw responding to this in a direct and tangible way were Roxane Gay and Shay Serrano, who were covering bills and groceries by sending out funds just through Twitter. And a week or so later, Frederick Joseph launched a rent relief fund on GoFundMe and was sending out $200 to people who were short on rent, bills, or groceries. And we were just really inspired by these efforts of, you know, individuals doing, you know, what they could to provide this, you know, direct and immediate relief to individuals and families. And so we thought about what we could do and what our role could be, you know, as an organization. And we reached out to GoFundMe to see if they would be opening to have us create a fund with a specific focus on families. And GoFundMe was so willing and supportive of us and brought us in alongside Fred's rent relief fund using the same model and donated the first $5,000 to get us started. And so basically the way that Fred's fund was set up was that, you know, he was raising money through the GoFundMe page and then sending out $200 payments to anyone that had a need or was a few hundred dollars short on rent, bills, or groceries. And so We use the same model, and 100% of all the funds raised go directly to the families. So none of us, you know, we're taking a percentage or paying ourselves at all for doing this. We're just facilitating, you know, this mutual aid effort of redistributing these funds.
I love that background on how you started it. Frederick Joseph is a good friend of GoFundMe, and he's been on the podcast before too. He's great. So I love that you were inspired by his actions. How would you say the mission behind your GoFundMe campaign for rent relief ties into the mission of the Conscious Kid?
Great. So one of the things like we talk about is, you know, intersectionality. So we talk about, you know, being interested in advocacy for youth, for family, and for parents. Income is a big part of that. And when we talk about supporting marginal groups, for example, like communities of color, there is a huge class intersection with that. And even low-income white folks, right? So it would be an injustice to say that we're here to fight oppression and to be advocates and not acknowledge the ways in which class is marginalizing people and intersects with their racial and everyday experiences. So as far as being there for families, being there for parents, right? There is a financial need that's there, and there is systemic like lack of access to resources, and all of that just gets further pronounced with COVID. So we just found that it was just a natural alignment with what we were already doing.
I love that. And to date, so for our listeners who may not have seen the campaign, over 10,000 people have raised almost $670,000 for your rent relief campaign, which is mind-blowing. It's just, yes. It's amazing. How does it feel sitting here and reflecting on that number, knowing that, you know, not only are people around the world supporting this mission, but that you were able to help so many families?
It's just a feeling of gratefulness, of overwhelming gratefulness, to just see how the community can come together and meet each other's needs. And not just grateful, it's empowering. Right. A lot of times, I think when we hit hard times, people think you have to depend on these dominant structures or systems. But this is something completely built for the people, by the people, grassroots. And a lot of these people aren't millionaires and have lots of money. They're donating what they can, $5, $7. But everybody, even if it's small, it adds up and it makes a massive impact. So not only is it just like this humbling, grateful, honoring experience, it's also eye opening for the power of community and how we can create our own agency and have our own resilience amidst circumstances of oppression.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling, but it's also, like you said, empowering. It's the right word. It just, things like this just give you hope, you know, and make you feel like, you know, there's a light, you know, and it's us as a community. It's beautiful. Have you been keeping track, like, how many total grants have you been able to give out at this point? I'm sure that's like an easy division problem for me to do, but do you know the total number?
I don't know the total number off the top of my head, but we do keep a spreadsheet of every single grant and the amount and the date. And so I'd have to follow up to get you that exact number, but we've given out over $500,000 so far. And I believe over 400,000 directly to Black families and 50,000 directly to the Black trans community.
Oh my gosh, that is... It's just beautiful. It's amazing. I'm amazed by you too. Have you had any particularly touching conversations with people who've received one of your grants?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, definitely. You know, people will reach back and they'll might send a photo or a nice message, and it shows you the massive impact of even, you know, whatever amount that they're able to receive, they're appreciative of it. Because of the fact that many will say they weren't going to be able to make rent. They may have been evicted. They may not have been able to put food at the table for that week, and they were figuring that out. I mean, people that were really pushed up against a wall, which I think is most folks, is how most folks are feeling in this time. And so even if whatever the amount is, it's people are extremely grateful, and the impact of it, it's not just like their livelihood, it's helping people just to survive and to persist. So all of that is super. Just it's touching. It's amazing. It's awakening. It's inspiring. Yeah,
I love that so much. So, looking toward the future a little bit, what's on the horizon for the Conscious Kid? Are there any, you know, other big things or ideas in the pipeline?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the major efforts that we've been working on in the last month or so is an anti-racist children's book education fund. And that is a fund where we'll be donating children's books that support conversations on race, racism, and resistance to Title I elementary schools all around the country. And we've actually raised now $1 million for this fund. So we'll be able to get these books into thousands of elementary schools across the country starting in September. So that's one big project that we're excited about and, you know, excited about having these conversations in elementary schools and in elementary classrooms and with young children and, you know, incorporating that into curriculum in the education system. So
that is so cool. Congratulations. That's huge.
Thank you. And then the other thing is just, you know, we'll keep sending out funds as long as people keep contributing to the COVID-19 rent relief fund. So that's just another thing that we'll continue doing as long as it continues receiving support. And we're so grateful. We didn't think that we'd be even still doing it now. You know, our initial goal was just to raise $10,000. So we are completely blown away that we're still receiving donations and able to send those out, you know, as soon as we get them. So we still have over $100,000 left to get out in this coming couple weeks too.
Wow. It's huge. That's so, I was just looking at the campaign and you got a bunch of donations today. So it's still going strong. So for anyone listening who is inspired by what you've done on all of these fronts and wants to make a difference in their communities, either supporting families in need or supporting anti-racist education work, what advice would you give to them?
So there's a couple of different ways. Most people have their own social media platforms and their own spaces. They can use their platform. Everybody has a voice to be able to kind of promote social justice goals and initiatives. But they're always welcome to also come into our site too. And whether it's something that we're talking about and repost that or support one of our funds that, whether it's the Anti-Racist Children's Book Fund or the COVID-19, they can get involved with our organization, or they can, you know, help support other local organizations either around their community and on the internet. There are, you know, lots of folks that do this work. So any way that they can see themselves getting involved, whether it's be having a conversation with a family member, having a conversation with a friend, or posting something online, there's all different ways that we can kind of push back and contribute. So, you know, whatever ways people feel is appropriate, as long as you're trying to do something.
I love that. And kind of as a closing thought, I would love to hear from each of you. If you hope that our listeners take away one thing from our conversation today, what would you hope that is?
I would say the power of community and showing up.
No doubt. Double stamp on that.
Thank you so much to the wonderful Katie M. Ramone for being on our podcast today. If you'd like to support their rent relief mission, please visit GoFundMe.com/rentrelieffamilies. You can also visit their website at theconscious kid.com, and be sure to follow them on Instagram at theconscious kid. They are awesome. Thank you so much for listening to True Stories of Good People, a GoFundMe Heroes production. If you were inspired by today's story, please help us out by heading over to iTunes and leaving a rating or review and subscribing to the show. And if anyone you know loves inspiring stories, please share our podcast with them. It means the world to us. For more inspiring stories just like the one you heard today, please visit the GoFundMe Heroes Hub at GoFundMe.com/heroes, and be sure to subscribe to our mailing list so you can get heartwarming stories delivered straight to your inbox. You can also follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at GoFundMe Heroes. Also, we love to hear from listeners, so if you have any feedback, suggestions, or questions, you can write to us at podcast@GoFundMe.com. Special thanks to Gotham Podcast Studio, where this episode was remotely recorded, and to our editing team at Cloud Studios in Seattle, Washington. We'll be back next time with more true stories of good people. Talk to you then!